162, which is Ramos versus District Court. Once parties have reconstituted, we can begin our next argument. If counsel is ready to proceed, please come forward and state your name and also any time you wish to reserve.
I would respectfully request 3 minutes of my time to reserve for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Abel Yanez. I'm here today on behalf of the petitioner, Gustavo Ramos. The district court in this case manifestly abused its discretion when it ruled that the narrow and limited exception in NRS 171.083 applied to the facts of this case. Petitioner is requesting that this court issue a writ of mandamus directing the district court to dismiss the sexual assault charge based on three reasons. Number one, the plain reading of the requirements of 171.083 and the facts of this case, we believe, show that those requirements have not been met. Number two, based on the language of 171.083, as well as its legislative history, we believe it's highly unlikely that the factual scenario in petitioner's case is applicable to the exception in the statute. And specifically, we don't believe that the legislature, when it passed NRS 171.083, had a scenario in mind where the alleged sexual assault victim is also deceased. Finally, assuming any ambiguity in the statute and its applicability to the facts of this case, pursuant to this court's prior decisions, as well as decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, any statute of limitations exceptions must be narrowly construed, and it must be read in the light most favorable to the petitioner.
Let me interject here, and I don't mean to derail you, but it's significantly of concern to me that the motion to dismiss these charges was filed in 2012, in the summer of 2012, and it was decided by the district court in the summer of 2012. 2 years pass. Nothing is done to remedy this egregious, writable abuse of discretion. Counsel is substituted. A new lawyer comes in. 2 more years pass, and we're now in the fall of 2016 on 2 murders that are alleged to have occurred almost 2 decades ago. What are we doing here with seeking writ relief 4 years after a district court judge denied a motion on an issue that is reviewable all day long on direct appeal from the judgment of conviction if one is imposed in this case?
And Justice Picker, I understand your concern. Part of the problem in that is the switching of attorneys. And I actually have an interesting point of view in this case because I was actually at the public defender's office when this case first started in 2010. And I was part of the defense team when we filed the motion to dismiss, which was denied. At that point, the district court put a stay on the proceedings. I actually left the public defender's office, and I believe it was Mr. Scott Coffey who continued working on the case. Why a writ was not taken up during that time, I'm unaware.
But then you come in 2 years later, and we have 2 more years before a writ is filed.
That is correct.
And I don't want to resolve this on laches. I'm not sure that we should entertain this as a matter of policy at all on a directly an issue that's going to be a front and center issue on direct appeal. I think the victim's family members, if they're still living, have an interest in seeing this case concluded in district court. It's been in our court now for a year and a half.
And that is correct, and it's been a large amount of time. Part of the issue is when I and my co-counsel took over the case, I believe it was in summer of 2014, it took a few months to get the entire file from the public defender's office. And then we had to somewhat plan a strategy on what we should tackle first. Due to the nature of this case and how long it had been since the alleged crime had happened, we wanted to try to investigate witnesses as quickly as possible.
Sure.
Due to memory issues, and as your honors know, in this case, the potential witnesses were living at an elderly assisted living facility. So we felt that was of prime importance. There's also, the court might be unaware, there's also an Atkins issue that is currently before the court that we have been developing for the past few years, which has required extensive travel throughout the country and travel to Mexico. So at the end of the day, obviously, if there's any delay, that falls on us. But we've tried to move the issue along as expeditiously as possible.
You would concede, would you not, that were we to deny this on procedural grounds, this issue that you're seeking to have us address today would be reviewable on direct appeal, the issue with respect to the statute of limitations?
It would be reviewable. We have preserved the issue, obviously, in the district court. But we think it's something, especially in a death penalty case, that should be resolved beforehand, so that the jury can be presented with the actual charges that are legitimately before the trial court and not necessarily something that has been blocked due to the statute of limitations. Again, these are issues if this court does not grant our writ, there's a possibility that the state could seek to amend its death notice and seek to add as an aggravator this charge if there's a conviction at the trial court. So,
because they could charge this even if it were barred by the statute of limitations as an aggravator, correct? In the, I don't know if charge is the right word, but the notice of death penalty can rely on an aggravator that the statute of limitations has run on, can it not?
It can, but it would be a different type of aggravator. It would be one less aggravator, yeah, depending on if it goes under the theory of it's an actual charge where there's a conviction versus just an act that they're going to present.
Don't let me dominate your time. I don't want to.
I'm sorry. Which is how they have it right now. It's not as an actual charge. And the reason for that is they file their notice of intent to seek the death penalty before they file their motion seeking to amend the information by affidavit. So at that point, when they gave notice, there was no charge. The justice court had not bounded over.
Okay. Thank you.
Has the issue been fully developed in the district court so that it's ripe here?
I believe so. I don't think there's a lot of dispute between the state and the defense as to the factual issues. I think both sides agree that as to the both of the witnesses that the district court relied on to find the exception applicable, I don't think there's a dispute as to what they did or didn't do. As to the friend of the victim in this case, I think both sides agree that she was a friend. She had no special authority to act as the statute does require. She did write a handwritten voluntary statement that's very brief, that makes no mention of the sexual assault, which the statute does require that the written report make some type of detail. The quote is concerning the sexual assault. We don't have that here in this case.
Counsel, is the written report limited to that statement, or is it the report, that statement plus or an official report that's filed, i.e. police report?
And Chief Justice, I think that's the issue, that's the disagreement that we have, and it depends on how you read the statute. I think if you're going to interpret the statute as the state does, the exception, which is a narrow exception, gets the rule gets eaten up by that exception. In this case, if you read the plain language of the statute, it says a written report. But even if you were to assume, well, it's a written report, let's assume that it's acceptable that the police filed a written report.
You have reports and you have statements.
Right. We can assume that. The problem is that the other requirements are also not met. The fact that it's either the victim or a person authorized to act on behalf of the victim makes the report.
But assume that the victim wasn't killed. I mean, the victim didn't wake up that morning thinking she was going to be raped and murdered that day, or sodomized, I guess is the word. But That happened. So she didn't pre-authorize that in the event I'm killed today, I'm going to authorize somebody to file a report for me. And that would reduce the statute to cases in which the victim is not killed in the course of the sexual assault.
That is correct, Judge, and that's why part of our position is we don't feel that this statute, when the legislature finally passed it, intended it for it to apply to situations where the alleged sexual assault victim is also murdered.
You think the policy is that if the sexual assault victim is murdered and they don't immediately identify the defendant, and so years pass and ultimately DNA turns up an identity, that the sexual assault will never be charged, and that's the public policy underlying the wording of this statute?
Well, I think that's how the legislature drafted it, and I don't think they intended.
I think that legislative intent is difficult to fathom.
That is true. And what I was going to point out, Justice Pickering, is, and we put this in our footnote 7 of our brief, what I found interesting is the statement from the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Mark James, where he said, I'm quoting him here, in a sexual assault crime, there was no dead person. So I think the way this statute evolved also supports the fact that the circumstances of our case are not applicable to the statute. This was originally a Senate Bill 97, which was meant to extend the statute of limitations to 7 years. During the committee process, they decided to change it to just getting rid of the statute of limitations completely. Concerns came up during that process. It's not crystal clear, but some of the concerns were they were afraid, the legislature was afraid of situations, if you have no statute of limitations, where there's a retaliatory accusation, perhaps accusations that fly in a divorce or custody dispute. So it appears, based on that, they decided to stick with the 4-year statute of limitation and then add this narrow and limited exception to cases where the victim is alive and makes a report, or perhaps the victim is underage or under some type of disability, and someone makes the report on their behalf.
Well, certainly death would be a profound disability.
That is correct. However, if you look at the plain language of that subsection, I believe it's subsection 4, it specifically notes for purposes of this section, a victim of a sexual assault is under disability if the victim is insane. They've amended it now. It's intellectual disability.
Right.
Back then it was MR. Mentally incompetent or in a medically comatose or vegetative state.
So your point really is that the legislature fouled this off if what they meant was for this statute to apply to people who were killed in the course of a sexual assault.
I'm sorry, Justice, can you put the first part of your question?
Yeah, you really say literally read a fair reading of this statute, that it does not apply to situations where the victim of the sexual assault is killed and therefore unavailable to make the report.
That is correct. And if the exception doesn't apply, the regular statute of limitations of 4 years is what does apply.
And that if they want to do something different, they need to amend the statute to say that.
That is correct, which they did somewhat change it in 2015. Now the statute of limitations is 20 years. The exception still applies, but now it's a 20-year period.
Counsel, you're at 2:30 at this point in terms of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Chief Justice. What I would like to end with is the arguments from the state require basically a rewriting of this statute. This statute is a narrow and limited exception to the general statute of limitations rule. It's not a catch-all to catch all these other type of cases. I think that was the intent of the legislature. This court, in interpreting statutes of limitations and exemptions, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court, the Morella case in 1984, the Murphy case in 1994, this court was explicit when it came to exceptions to the statute of limitations. They must be read in the light most favorable to the petitioner, and they must be narrowly construed. In order to find support for the state's position and for the district court's position, there basically has to be a twisting, turning, almost a complete rewrite of this statute in regards to who is a person that is authorized does, what Chief Justice Douglas brought up, is the police reports themselves, is that sufficient as a written report, even though it's not commenced by the victim or a person authorized to act on behalf of the victim?
Sir, why can't Detective Ramos be a person authorized to act on behalf of a person who's incapacitated? Well, why can't he be a person that is authorized in that fashion?
Well, it could be read that way. Our position is that that would be almost a rewrite of the statute and the intent behind the statute. Number one, the plain language of the statute says victim or person authorized to act on behalf of the victim. So if we even assume that Detective Ramos was a person authorized, that just takes care of one of the requirements. What it doesn't do is it doesn't talk about the other requirements of concerning a sexual assault and or that that person has been authorized. You have the written report aspect, but we still get, I think, twisted and turned as to whether he qualifies under the two different exceptions. And like I said, the intent from this legislature, from what I could at least glean from the legislative history, is that this was to avoid those type of retaliatory divorce case type cases where someone pops up 20 or 30 years later. I think that was the intent of this statute.
Well, to try to seek contemporaneous evidence at the time, so to go against a false complaint, but why doesn't Detective Ramos's contemporaneous observations at the time, which are recorded in a police report, satisfy those concerns?
Well, because I believe it's a rewrite of the statute. Because I can think of another scenario in researching and looking at this case. If you have a domestic violence situation between a husband and a wife, and you have a family member and a neighbor who call the police, and they fill out their reports, and they call 911 just like the witnesses did in this case, but nothing's mentioned of a sexual assault, the state's position, the district court's position, would be 20, 30 years down the road, back in 1997, the statute was waived because a neighbor called, a police officer investigated it.
Oh, that's not correct, because your hypothetical presumes that they don't mention anything about sexual assault. Detective Ramos specifically put in the report evidence about sexual assault. Your hypothetical eliminates that. If the neighbor called and said, "And I saw him grabbing her breasts or doing some other sexually assaulted behavior," that would preserve it, correct?
Well, our position is that it wouldn't, that it doesn't, that is not what how the statute reads. Perhaps the spirit of the statute, you could say that hypothetically that would apply, but again, if the statute, if it's required to read this statute narrowly and interpret it narrowly, and that's what this court has said, and to give the benefit of the doubt to the petitioner and not to the state, then I don't think that argument carries water. What it appears the district court did is it gave the benefit of the doubt and it construed it broadly for the state's argument and not for the petitioner's argument. This court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has said the opposite must occur. And I think I've passed my time, so thank you.
On behalf of the state.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Thum, and I represent the state of Nevada in this matter. The district court correctly denied petitioner's motion to dismiss count 3, the sexual assault charge in this case, because the exception to the statute of limitations for sexual assault identified in NRS 171.083 applies in this case.
Why should we intervene at this time?
At this time, this is an appellable issue, as Justice Pickering mentioned. Latches potentially would apply due to the unreasonable delay in the filing. I believe that the court could procedurally deny this petition based on those grounds. However, I do believe that the exception to the statute of limitations for sexual assault based on NRS 171.083 applies in this case.
I guess it'd be a real favor to the defense to keep this issue alive and well for negotiation purposes in a death penalty case.
Potentially, you understand that? Strategically, yes. But I believe the exception does apply, and I'd like to apply those facts to the statute.
Before we go down the road with that, I'd like to discuss with you the policy, and it's separate from the laches concern. Let's forget that it's been 4 years, or now almost five, since the actually almost 5.5 years since the district court ruled on the motion to dismiss, right?
Yes.
So we'll come up on the six-year anniversary of the motion to dismiss this summer, right?
Justice.
Let's put all that to one side and just say it's timely and this petition's before us. As a matter of policy, should this court be entertaining writ petitions in criminal cases concerning statutory construction issues that are fully reviewable on appeal?
I would submit to you, no, Justice. We did receive...
And why? Educate us on... Make that argument, if you will.
Well, I believe, Justice, because they do have... it is an appellable issue, and they do have the remedy of seeking it on direct appeal. That would simply create, if you would... a clog in the a logjam in the Supreme Court if every issue such as this was brought up on a writ of mandamus, and I just don't believe that's the appropriate vehicle to address these issues. I believe the direct appeal would be.
It'd be helpful to you to have a definitive ruling from us, though. So you want us to go ahead and reach it on the merits in this case, or not?
I would like to address the merits in this case because I do believe it's important given the factual scenario that we have here with the deceased victim of a sexual assault, the timeliness of the reporting and the requirements by statute, what is necessary in order
So it's just advisory opinions from us on, I mean, maybe the guy will go to trial and be acquitted. So why should we be doing this?
I believe that it can be, again, we don't have to reach the merits, but I'm prepared to argue it pursuant to the order by this court that expedited the briefing and our response to it.
Right. Thank you.
While you're on this point, do you agree with your opponent here that all of the facts connected with this exception are uncontested? You folks, both sides, essentially agree that the facts giving rise to the application of the exception are clear and undisputed and not contested and would come out the same way if presented to the jury.
Yes, Justice Hardesty, I do believe the facts are somewhat uncontroverted. We're applying the same facts to the statute, albeit with different interpretations.
Either uncontroverted or they're controverted, not somewhat.
I don't believe we have a dispute as to what the facts are in this case.
Okay.
I believe
there's no dispute about who provided the report and where it came from and whether there was or wasn't authorization. It's more about how you interpret this statute.
Correct.
In that regard, can you address opposing counsel's argument that there was no mention of sexual assault by the neighbor who did the written report, and therefore the statute doesn't apply?
I think the written reports as presented in the statute can be extrapolated to the police investigation as a whole.
It was incorporated into a bigger report.
Yes. I believe that the starting point is who discovers the crime, the neighbor, Peggy Parks. She stumbled upon, finds her neighbor in a pool of blood, and that's exactly what her written statement to the police indicates. Detective Ramos, her son, the autopsy, the CSA reports, all of these corroborate the sexual assault that was perpetrated upon this victim.
Who worked with her on that report, on that statement? Who worked with her?
The reporting officer that provided her the voluntary statement,
and
I believe.
They didn't tell her what the statute says about having to include the sexual assault. Was there discussions about that with the reporting person?
I have no knowledge of that, Justice Cherry. I believe what my position is that when you extrapolate written reports to include the entire police investigation as a whole, you have...
And RA 64 includes photos of the decedent with her clothes up and her bra off. And
correct.
And that's part of the police file in this case, correct?
It was, Justice Pickering. In terms of authorization to act, I believe That also incorporates many individuals. As Justice Stiglitz gave reference to Detective Ramos or Officer Ramos, I believe the neighbor, the son, every law enforcement officer and medical professional involved in the investigation of this are authorized to act on behalf of the victim. I believe the reporting requirement within the four-year stretch is essentially a shield against late disclosures. Counsel also made reference to that. I believe he gave it a hypothetical in the case of a divorce proceeding. But I believe that the legislative intent was to provide a reporting requirement against late disclosures, along with the removal of the statute of limitations for sexual assaults. Obviously, a layperson versus a law enforcement officer would have less knowledge in terms of the investigation and documentation and knowledge of the elements of sexual assault. I believe, as Justice Cherry gave reference to just a moment ago, did this officer tell them what to include by way of the statute? Well, at that point, the investigation had no way of knowing that they weren't going to find the individual within 4 years to file. This was an ongoing police investigation, but essentially, the requirements had been met of 171.083, which told the statute of limitations and ultimately allowed for this cold case to be resurrected once a DNA match happened in 2009, along with a palm print, I might add. I would submit that this also encourages reporting. Think of the scenario in which an individual is illiterate or a person that is authorized by a victim to report is illiterate. They can't potentially write a written statement. However, they reach out to law enforcement and they provide them, they report this incident to them. And then once again, the written requirement that I submit to you can be extrapolated to the law enforcement reports accompanying the investigation all the way through the medical examiner's reports. I'd like to go down to also look at 171.083 subsection 2. It requires a law enforcement officer to provide a copy of the written report to the person reporting. If you were to accept counsel's interpretation of this statute that it has to be a written report to law enforcement, this would be redundant. Why would an officer turn around and give the same report that someone gave to them right back to them? This would be a redundancy, and I believe it shows that that wasn't what this means when they say written report. It's, again, the extrapolation to all law enforcement officers involved. And I do think, Justice Pickering, also you touched upon it too, that applying the facts in this case, it would be a rather absurd outcome that the victim would have been required to have the foresight to understand that she was going to be raped and murdered and then pre-authorize someone such as her son or her neighbor, Ms. Peggy Parks in this case, to file a written report on her behalf to law enforcement. That just, it wouldn't make sense and it would be an absurd outcome.
Could you address your argument on laches? I think I kind of cut you off on that with my line of questioning at the beginning.
And thank you, Justice Pickering. I believe my point was is that, and it was laid out in some detail during counsel's argument and his colloquy with you, Justice, that in fact 2 years went by before the motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss was denied by written order of the district court, August 7th of 2012. It is true that a motion to withdraw counsel occurred on 2014. 2016 is when we finally get this petition filed. I appreciate counsel's candor, indicating that he was originally part of the motion to dismiss back in 2012, and I think that lends to laches. It's an unreasonable delay. If it was going to be made, it should have been made more contemporaneous to the district court's written order coming up on its six-year anniversary, and I do believe it would apply in this case.
Did I miss?
Want us to find laches, and that's per se ineffective assistance of counsel. So you'll be back again on this one.
Well, I don't believe it would be ineffective assistance of counsel because I don't believe he
would. Violet, laches isn't ineffective? Well, what is it?
He wouldn't have prevailed on this motion.
Well, we haven't decided that yet.
And my position would be that he wouldn't.
I understand that, but you understand that you're creating, by saying this would be laches, ineffective assistance of counsel. I mean, somebody, would it be Mr. Yanez or Mr. Coffey, somebody should have filed this a long time ago.
Assuming that this writ is granted, or this petition is granted.
Counsel, did I misunderstand your opponent there? I thought he said there was a stay entered at some point.
What happened
could
was...
Could you comment on that?
Oh, I'm sorry, Justice. I didn't
that's
mean
okay.
to interrupt.
No, that's all right.
What happened was that the court entertained argument on July 27th, 2012, in the transcript that is available. The court does indicate that they weren't making a decision at that time, that they would issue a stay, and they actually encouraged counsel to bring it up to your honors on a writ. However, 1 week or 10 days later, the court did issue a written order. It was approximately 7 pages long, where they, in fact, did deny the motion with regard to count 3, the sexual assault charge. However, they did grant the motion to dismiss as to count 4, the sexual penetration of a dead human being. So there was an oral stay. However, a written order was filed 10 days later that ruled on the issue.
Oh, okay, so this stay was just for the period of time to get the order concluded.
Correct.
So there has not been a stay in this case, or there has been a stay in this case?
There is not currently a stay in this case. It's currently set for a status check next month for a setting of a trial.
So how many times has it been set for trial?
I believe it has only been set for trial once prior to numerous motions. I know counsel made reference to the Atkins issue that's been developed over the course of the last year.
Said it's been set for trial 7 times. That would be an error?
In my review of the record, I don't recall it being set 7 times, but I could be wrong. Unless there are any other questions, I'll submit them out.
Unless if there are no additional questions, we stand in recess, counsel. You've used all your available time.